All right. Welcome back to the Pursuing Purpose podcast. I'm your host, BC Cerna. So excited to be here with my lovely... You can... Hey! Okay, with my lovely, encouraging, amazing, somewhat attractive. Would you say you're attractive?
When I'm around you, I feel more attractive.
Okay, somewhat around me, more attractive. Mediocre. I've heard, though, you're attractive. I've heard you're attractive. Guys, welcome back. This is episode 21.
Is it really?
Yeah, this is episode 20 or 21.
Yeah. When you peaked, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. I peaked at 20, and now I'm living in the garage. Guys, I'm so excited. This is the Pursuing Purpose podcast. We're back, and with one of my oldest friends, the oldest people I know, and oldest friends, if you know what I mean, Houston Kraft, which I'm excited. This has been a long time coming. I've had this podcast for a minute, and you've yet to be on it. And then I ran out of guests at 20 friends and my mom. I used my mom and a bunch of other strangers, hit 20 friends of all of my people I know. And then I was like, man, who's after my mom? And then I was like, I guess I got to call Houston up.
Yeah, it does feel weird to say like, oh, I was excited to have you at the party that I didn't invite you to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sort of like after the fact, like, oh, it would have been so nice to have you and I didn't invite.
Yeah, I didn't. You, you mean my birthday party?
Any really event.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. This is Houston. He's a great friend. And I hope you guys know I'm kidding. You know I'm kidding, right? Welcome to this podcast, baby. We go there, dude. We go there. Houston is a world-renowned speaker and now author and best friend. He's a world-renowned best friend, too. We've known each other for a minute. We met through the interwebs. I was at a conference in San Francisco and some dude, I don't remember his name.
My college roommate.
Your college roommate.
Christian.
Yeah. Christian, yeah. He goes, I was telling him what I do. And he's like, oh, you got to meet my old roommate, Houston Kraft. And I looked him up. And I was like, this dude, really? Bow tie? And then I was like, this dude's dope. And so we met up in Denver eventually. Hit it off. We had ice cream together when we first met at Union Station. And then we went our separate ways, stayed in touch. And then you moved to LA. I moved to LA. And we became friendsters.
Yeah.
We friendstered. And then we birthed like a friendship.
Yeah.
That's
what happens when you friendster without being careful.
At one point, you're hosting Perry and I living in your one bedroom apartment. When we're launching the Traveling Good. Perry and I are like living at Houston's one bedroom, and then we go on the Traveling Good, then you join us throughout the Traveling Good. So we've been part of this, like we've kind of like just always done cool stuff together. Then you came to Denver and spoke at like the high school program, the National Leadership Academy. And then you've been a high school speaker for like 10 years now.
Yeah.
Speaking at high schools, teaching kids about kindness, about self-love, about empathy and compassion. And now you're releasing a book after all this data you've gathered. And you like literally jumped into this with a mentor of yours, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can we back up to like when you met this mentor, John?
Yeah. Yeah. A mentor and an influence. Yeah. Sort of like in the trenches experiences has led me to the book, and it started in many ways. You mentioned that I spoke at a camp that you're really passionate about and have been for a long time. It's been transformational in your life. I had the same deal. Summer camp's a magic place.
Yeah.
I think anyone has a summer camp bond. There's something there automatically. In fact, the research says that one of the most effective empathy building structures is camp.
Wow.
Which I love. It makes sense. You smash strangers into the same space. You put them through intentional challenges and you create communities. Oftentimes that'll last a lifetime. So I was at a camp in Washington State where I'm from, and this guy was speaking on stage. The camp was a leadership camp. So he was talking about how leadership was really about the exercise of love. And he changed a lot of my paradigms around what it meant to lead, to have a quote-unquote position of leadership. And he ended up being the first person that ever hired me to speak at his school. And then fast forward to 2016, we came together and we co-founded this company, Character Strong. So now together, him and I, he was a classroom teacher. I wandered around and spoke at schools for 7 years, spoke at 600 high schools and middle schools all over North America. And while he was an administrator and a teacher, and we came together to create Character Strong, which now the goal is, okay, we can go school to school talking, telling stories, which has its place, but how do you create the systems and education to effectively change the way we change what we teach to young people to think about, okay, what's beyond academics? Well, it's things like empathy. It's things like emotional regulation. It's things like patience or forgiveness or generosity or connection, and being able to teach those things explicitly and build that into the system of education. That's where I want my work to be about.
That's awesome. Yeah. So almost like you guys' mission was an extra curriculum kind of thing. And now it's like almost should be part of the culture. Mm-hmm. Like your dream and vision is to create something that is a cultural implementation of the education system.
Yeah.
Where it's like a school, all schools have it. It's just not anything different.
Yeah.
Which is so exciting because I think schools like Montessori schools and private schools have these unique aspects where they're able to like incorporate things like that. And now it's like, well, public school, everyone should have that. Yeah. And so you've been doing that for a while. How old were you when you met John at this camp?
17.
17. Okay. And then you were inspired by him and then you kind of like went under his wing a little bit and then created this character. So it's, I don't know. I love walking people through their 20s, you know, like I love like asking you were when you were 20 years old, what you were doing. What were you doing?
I was starting my speaking career. I taken a year off of college and I started working in schools. And I know mentorship is a passion of yours, and I feel super lucky. I have this mentor who's 10 years older, John. I have another mentor who's 20 years older, Tyler, who's sort of my storytelling mentor, speaking mentor. So I kind of have this like character, heart, leadership mentor in my life. And then I have this older mentor who also balances a lot of those things, but also has like walked me through how to tell meaningful stories, how to build a career out of speaking and telling those stories. So those mentors in my life were just like massive. Because when I was 20, I knew I wanted to say something. You just don't know how to say it. And you don't know where to go next. And you don't know who your champions are. And you don't know always what to do when you find even many steps of success. And how do you stay aligned to who you want to be? And
yeah. Yeah. And it's like very intimate, like where books, there's books like Tony Robbins can write a book and you can read it where it's like, it's kind of like my mentor, but there's something so intimate about, well, first of all, heart-led leaders, like heart-led mentors, and that just like see something in you and go, wow, I really want to invest in that person. And then like, yeah, elevate them and be like your teammate. And then, so then 20 years old, you start speaking and you have this John mentor that's 10 years and you have a mentor that's 20 years older. And it's cool because mentors come in so many different shapes and sizes. There's like spiritual mentors and business mentors. And then you and John, at what age did you and John create the Character Strong?
I was 26.
Okay. So 20 to 26, you were like, you were speaking and doing your own thing and creating your own kind of programs and, mm-hmm. and message. And then 26, you guys were like, let's team up and create something together.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'd always admired. He did incredible work in schools, and had an amazing reputation, like in the building. And we had like a cool intersection of skills where I'd wandered to 600 campuses, so I'd kind of had like the spread wide, meant like the breadth, and he had the depth of doing it in an individual school and in one campus, one district. And I said, if you can do this in a district, and I've wandered talking to 600 places, like how do we scale that? You know, systemically in education, how do we bring this nationally? Or
I love that. Yeah, because it's just what I always kind of say in my messaging curriculum is like anyone can do what they're passionate about by themselves, but you need people to do what your purpose is. Like you need community. You cannot do your purpose alone.
Yeah.
Because your purpose brings you to your shadows and your weakness and your knees, kind of where you're like, hey, you can do this really well. I can do this really well. Let's do it together. Yeah. And I need you.
Yeah,
and so you need people for your purpose, and I love that. And so what you guys did was saw both each other's strengths and said, "Hey, let's not compete, or like let's not go different. Let's try not to like create different wheels. Let's create something together." And since then, you've worked in hundreds of schools. Your curriculum's in
2,500 schools,
and you've been able to connect with tens of thousands of students, and now you're working on the book, and the book is coming out in a month, exactly, almost.
Yeah, a month. Month from today.
Yeah. So what's the book about?
The book is a distillation of wandering around to 600 schools and having the intimate experience of the speaking world is unique in the sense of like you are a stranger, you're a passing ship through someone's very personal life, because you show up, spill out a lot of vulnerable stories with the hope of connecting to their stories. And when you do, for many, especially young people, but I suppose all of us, right, that intersection of stories is a really fascinating, it's the best gift of speaking. You get on stage, you tell a story, and if for some reason it intersects with someone's story in the audience, it's not the same names, it's not the same places, but like that intersection of theme or hope or need or revelation for some people, like there's that sense of, I have to tell you about this. And so kids will come up to you and be like, this reminds me of this, or you've lived this, or I've lived this. So I had that time 600 and thousands of students along the way. And then working in schools at sort of like that scale and thinking about the education system and realizing what's broken, not just in education, but like the cultural pursuits and the cultural messaging that I get to see first or second hand, however you want to think about it, like kids get exposed to. And the reason why they crave the things that they do is because of the messages that we give them. You know, we say that they're lazy or entitled or selfish. And it's like, well, that's just a byproduct of what we've offered them, you know, collectively as older people, as a generation, as role models, as an adult, as culture, we pass on that message of like, hey, this is who you're supposed to be, or this is what you want or are supposed to need. And so the book is really trying to unpack what culture has offered us and why it prevents us from living a life of kindness. Because the argument of the whole book is we all collectively agree kindness is a good thing, and yet we are collectively not very good at it. Why is that? What prevents us from living the kind of life that we claim to want for ourselves and for others? So the book explores that, unpacks that, tries to figure out what the answer to that question is, and then provide tools to make it better.
So good. That's amazing. And then you probably have to delve into like systems or culture or like history of probably like evolution, right? Like you'd probably have to talk about certain things of how we got here. Does the book touch base on that?
Yeah, the book takes a look at like, yeah, the transitions we've gone through as a culture. For example, one of my favorite paradigm shifts comes from Susan Cain, who wrote this book called Quiet, The Amazing Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And she says that you look over the past 100 years and the things that we value has changed. And her evidence is she takes self-help books from a century ago. And she tries to find the most commonly used words or phrases. And she finds that 100 years ago, the things that people were trying to get better at, as evidenced in the texts that they were reading for self-help, were things like courage, integrity, respect, service. She did the same experiment with self-help books from today, and the most commonly used words or phrases or ideas were things like, how do I be more popular, more charming, more funny, more interesting? And the language she uses, if we're thinking about this from like a cultural evolution standpoint, is we've shifted from a culture of character to a culture of personality. Culture of character, which says like, how do I improve myself so that I can actually turn around and support my community, my school, my world? To a culture of personality, which is, how do I improve my reputation, my brand, my followers, me? And so we can say to young people, oh, they're selfish or entitled, but maybe we have to take one more step back and say, what is the messaging that we've created that might inculcate that message or belief in them? And then how do we turn that ship around, right? How do we move back towards a culture that is more focused on generosity and connection as opposed to sort of this independence narrative that everyone's their own entity, that everyone's their own creator, that, I mean, which is a good, right? There's pieces of that that are healthy. Mm-hmm. And then there's pieces of that that actually disrupt our capacity for compassion.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I love that because, you look at cultures, you can see how certain things evolve, but character is one that I feel like, yeah, we're kind of falling back on, because character is what you do when no one's watching and now everyone's watching. And so we're trying to understand. I think we're just wrestling with this new age of technology of like I noticed the most genuine people, most authentic people struggle with social media really bad because it is, and some people can learn how to balance it really well. Some people go, okay, social media is this thing. It's a brand. It's like a product. And how do I best authentically approach it? in a wholesome way. And it's like this friction of like, it, I don't know. It's just, I think we're all trying to navigate that in a world where it's like some people have even restrained it and you know, pushed it away a long time. And they're like, I'm not going to do it. This and this. And then it's kind of like, oh dang, I kind of have to, like, I have to evolve or participate in this thing. But yeah, we're just trying to navigate that. And I think what you tie into is so great, because empathy and kindness, like I was reading another day, and there was a quote that said, the opposite of narcissism is generosity. Mm-hmm. And it was just like such a good way to look at it. You know, it's just like, how generous are we being? How much do we trust in like love to have an open hand, you know? And the narcissism's kind of like, narcissists aren't generous, because anything with my money, I could do better than you can do it if I give you my money, right? I can control it. I have more control. And I think with the COVID and with this 2020 hitting us right here, especially, I'm sure this book's going to be so relevant for people, is we're like now no longer desensitized and numbing ourselves to now our emotions and feelings come up. And we're just like, whoa, what am I without my identity? What am I without sports distracting me? What am I without all these distractions? And now people have found, I think, breakthroughs during COVID. I think that isolation, I know it was tough for a lot of people, but I think if you write down the pros and the cons, I think there was beauty that came from it, and then a lot of toughness too. But in that toughness is where usually beauty comes, you know?
Yeah.
And so this book is going to, I think, touch people's lives. It's coming quick. I can't believe it's like literally you were writing it in February.
Yeah, well, it got picked up by Simon & Schuster in February.
Yeah.
I finished it in January. The whole thing came together with some fun serendipity. Yeah.
So good.
There's so many things that you shared there that I feel like I want to talk about.
Yeah.
One of them being sort of the classic quote that kind of, or characters what we do when no one's watching. And I love that you qualified it with like, but now everyone's watching. And I would, yeah, I like to fight back against that, because I think that is an important reminder for all of us, that I think a lot of us are good, like kind people when we don't have to deal with other people, when no one's watching, right?
Yeah.
But really, like a test of our compassion is what we do when we are confronted by the reality of living in community with other people. So what we do behind the scenes is an element of our compassion, but also what we do when we're confronted by the reality of showing up and living in a culture that's not just us is the challenge of what the book calls like deep kindness, right? How do I engage in this when it's not just me? I love that you talked about narcissism and generosity being these sort of opposite ends of a scale. Some of my favorite research on empathy comes from Dr. Michelle Borba, and she says that in all of her research, 2 decades of research on empathy, she's discovered that the biggest barriers are fear, anxiety, and narcissism. Those are the 3 things that prevent us from empathizing with others. And what have we seen an increase of over the past few decades? Fear, anxiety, narcissism. And I think it's a reminder that we are both the victims of that problem and the perpetrators of it, right? Is that people aren't just naturally more narcissistic all of a sudden. We create the framework that makes that true. And one of my favorite quotes is, every system is designed perfectly to get the results that it gets.
Yeah.
And that's what we have. We have a system that is creating narcissism, fear, and anxiety, and it is operating perfectly. The consequences of increased fear, narcissism, and anxiety is that we actually have a harder time empathizing with each other. And it makes sense, right? The more worried I am about what's going on in my life, the harder time I have thinking about what's going on in yours.
Yeah.
And that is one of the blessings and curses of something like COVID, is that we are collectively more scared than ever. And then we also have more time to think about it, which is one of the things the book tries to dig into, is in that space where we're afraid or dealing with big emotions, do we have the tools to actually confront them? And do we have the tools to think through what to do next? And what sort of framework do I have in my mind to think about, okay, how do I take these big challenging emotions and still show up with generosity for myself or with other people? And there's this great quote by Dr. Ross Green. He says, kids do well when they can. He's a child psychologist. Implication being, anytime a kid behaves in a way that we quote unquote don't want them to, it's for one of 2 reasons. He says lagging skills and unsolved problems, which simply means like either I don't have the right competencies, like I don't have the tools in my toolbox to behave in this moment the way I need to, or I have problems going on behind the scenes that affect the foreground. my adaptation of that quote in the book is people do well when they can, because we don't, when we hit 18, get handed a, like, you're all set diploma. Like, our problems don't suddenly get resolved, and we don't just naturally get gifted with the tools of self-reflection, the tools of emotional regulation, the tools of connection. Right? Those are still things that we have to learn. All that to say, this time for a lot of people has been confrontational, because it's terrifying for many. It's anxiety inducing. And if I haven't been given those tools, like, where am I going to get them? You know, who's going to teach them to me? So people, I think, have been taking this time to both unpack those things. And then people have been taking this time and have, I think, frankly, been overwhelmed by them and don't know where to go next.
End scene.
I don't know. I got lots more to say.
I know. We could talk about this forever because, this is where we're at. And I think people are like, it's so weird because with COVID and being isolated, we couldn't go to even homeless shelters or go help people even, like, you know, and like go help hospitals or whatever it was. And so people were like, I need to serve, because I think they were like so done isolating, and now there's just like this desire for compassion, empathy, and I don't know. I think we can take this so many different directions with what the system is. I think so the book is going to be, people read it, they experience it, because how do we change culture is the question. How do we change the system?
Inside out and outside in. So the book, the framework of the book, it starts by painting the picture of the problem, right? If we don't acknowledge the issue. And the issue in my mind is that the way we talk about kindness in our culture doesn't honor how hard it is. So I think we sometimes think about kindness as this fluffy thing. And I think that's perpetuated by even the way the news talks about it, right? Anytime you see good news on the news, it's almost always about like Starbucks Pay It Forward line, or there's like the GoFundMe that was raised $1 million to support this person in need. Which, don't get me wrong, like, many of these things are really powerful, but they can sometimes diminish those daily acts of deep compassion that need to happen interpersonally. So the whole first chunk of the book is like painting the picture of what is missing when it comes to kindness. And there's a whole portion that starts with this premise of people more actively seek Advil than vitamins, which I heard that a few years ago and I was like, oh, that is such a frustrating truth.
Yeah.
You know, that we will actively seek ways to pull ourselves out of pain more than be proactive in reducing that pain in the first place. And I think that kindness can sometimes be taken for granted as both the pain reliever, but also the vitamins themselves. Like it can and should be both.
Yeah.
And so we talk about like, what is that cultural history, that evolution of how we arrived here at culture. It talks about the inundation that we have with data and social media being a piece of that. You know, the average person is exposed to 34 gigabytes of information a day, over 100,000 words. And you just think about like all that inbound data, which when you think about the timeline of our capacity to evolve, to keep up with the ability to sift through that data, that doesn't match up.
Yeah.
So we get all this inbound data, and I think we forget sometimes that it's not all true, and it's all not all good for us, and yet it gets in there, it gets into our system, and it causes us to, it prevents us from many ways being the sort of kind, generous people that we want to be, even if we're not paying attention to it. So the book sort of breaks down what gets in the way. What gets in the way for me personally, and then what gets in the way for us sort of systemically.
Wow.
And it's three main categories. The first one's incompetence, which is just like, if I don't know how to do a thing, sometimes I won't do it. Second one is insecurity, which is if I'm afraid of doing a thing, then I won't do it. The third one is inconvenience. If I don't feel like doing a thing, then I won't do it. So you think about all three of those through the lens of kindness, like incompetence as an example. Incompetence as an example, you know, you and I, we live close to the mecca of bodybuilding, Gold's Gym. And I remember the first time I went in there, I realized how incompetent I was. And you look at some of these machines and you're like, I bet these would make me stronger, but I'm never going to know how to use these. And if I don't know how to use a machine, especially in a public space like that, I'm going to avoid it and go to the things that I do know how to do. Same thing's true with kindness. I'm going to lean on the things that I already know how to do as opposed to try the new machine that looks like a transformer.
Yeah.
So think about what are the competencies, as an example, that we're missing as individuals or collectively as a society that lend themselves to the practice of kindness. So you think about kindness as the behavior, the action. What are all the things that need to work in concert beneath that action in order for kindness to be effective? So I think about something like empathy. And if I'm not good at listening or understanding what people need, then my kindness isn't going to necessarily meet people's needs. Simple but powerful example that I discovered while writing the book, Sandy Hook shooting happened in Newtown, Connecticut. People from all over the world wanted to be kind in this moment of tragedy. So people from all over the world sent teddy bears, stuffed animals. So many teddy bears that the town had to rent a warehouse, 20,000 square foot warehouse, just to house all these inbound teddy bears. The guy that planned the candlelit vigil said that there were more stuffed animals than there were people. And in a really profound quote, he said, you know, a stuffed animal's great, but a teddy bear won't pay for counseling, and a teddy bear won't pay for a funeral. And to me, I was reminded, just reading that quote, I was like, dang, sometimes I'm doing something that I think is kind, but I've never bothered to ask if it's what they need. And in that situation, I would suggest that your kindness actually benefits you more than the person you're giving it to.
Yeah.
So if I don't have the skill of empathy, or if I haven't cultivated and improved on that, so it's not something you turn on or off, you can improve at it. But the skill of empathy is about feeling with people and understanding what they need, taking their perspective in a way that allows us to tap into what they actually need in the moment. And what I talk about in the book is if we can learn to listen well, we can love better.
Yeah.
But sometimes we dismiss that empathy is an ingredient of this more complicated puzzle, right? That the action of kindness is actually predicated first on the competency of empathy. Forgiveness, right? Sometimes an action of kindness requires forgiveness for myself or for this person that I'm trying to give this kindness to, because if my kindness doesn't have forgiveness as a part of it, then it becomes conditional, right? I will only give you kindness if I agree with you, or if I don't have a grudge towards you, or if I'm not angry with you at the moment, right? Which is just conditional kindness. But forgiveness is a whole beast unto itself, right? So if I haven't thought about what forgiveness looks like in my life, the book talks about it as separating the person from the behavior, separating the human from the hurt, and recognizing that we sometimes do bad things, but we're not bad people. And if we can create that space, then I can look at you through a much more generous lens, and I can still show up in kindness for you, even if you've hurt me before.
Hmm.
So the book spends, you know, that's one of the parts, one of the things that gets in the way. And it begs us to take first and foremost, if we're going to change culture, we have to change ourselves. And I'm upfront about it. I say, this book is not your high-flying inspirational storybook on kindness. Like, those are out there and those are good, right? We all need a little bit of inspiration and motivation. This one's prickly. It's designed to be like, hey, what are we missing to give this thing that we know is important and yet we're not oftentimes real good at giving?
Yeah. So good, man. I love that. Yeah, no, that book's going to be amazing. And like that, those topic points of there's friction, right? There is difficultness of it, of like where it's like shadow work kind of thing that's becoming really talked about now, of like, and Brene Brown kind of paved this way, and so did Tommy Spaulding and Tony Robbins, of like this whole like trauma work and shadow work. And it's like, what is the barrier? Yeah, what is getting in the way systematically, culturally, biologically, in the way of us becoming the full potential of love and surrender to empathy and compassion? And I love compassion. The Greek definition is to suffer with, to co-suffer. And so you can't learn compassion. You can read a million books and be really smart PhD, but to actually learn it, you have to feel pain. You have to cry with that person, or feel those mirror neurons go off in your body of like, oh my God, that person, their mom just died. What if my mom, you know, that whole experience of compassion is intangible and to learn, you have to feel it. And so, yeah, that's amazing, man. We've been doing this work. I think it's so cool, like us becoming best friends, because we've been doing this work kind of like differently in different avenues with young people for so long, and just being so inspired by this next generation that is, I think, evolved more than we are. Even though we do see the darkness a little bit more, and we do highlight the, you know, we say, oh, this is like a really selfish culture or generations like that. But we're like, me and you are in the schools being like, no, nah, there's 15-year-old kids starting nonprofits to help homeless people. Like there's there, it's there, it's there, and it's bigger than ever. And then how do we replicate it and multiply it and grow it and encourage it and then embody it? And like what we talk about a lot is, how do you love in the hard times, right? How do you love, how do you forgive, how do you love the hard people and those questions and stuff. So it's good, man. I love one of the things you said the other day. There was a study that this human species found out they were starting to evolve when they had compassion, remember? Because there was the femur.
Yeah.
Can you share that real quick?
Yeah, it's Margaret Mead, who's a famous cultural anthropologist. Right, their jobs are to like look at how societies evolve and come to be. And I heard this for the first time from Brad Montague, who's an amazing author and speaker. And I love the premise of it. It's in his book, Becoming Better Grownups. And he talks about how at one point someone asked Margaret Mead this question. How do you know when civilization starts? Like, what is the definition of the beginning of civilization? Is it the political system? Is it agriculture? And she says it's a healed femur. And they're like, all right, that's a vague answer. What do you mean by that? She goes, no, when you discover, if you're able to dig up a femur that has been healed, it's been bound together, cast and refused, it is evidence that people have gone back to help that person through pain. Because all of our biology would tell us to move on, right? The innate sort of primal protection mechanisms that we have, we would never go back to help someone who has a broken leg. But they found these femurs that have been healed, and she says that's how you know civilization begins. When someone has made the choice to fight back against those primal instincts and to go back and help when there's really no benefit to them. That's where civilization begins.
So good.
Healed femurs.
Healed femurs, baby. Kind of like when you had compassion, empathy, and love, when you have evolved past the biology, right? Mm-hmm. When humans separated from the animal kingdom, you know, of this idea of like, yeah, animal kingdom is just very biology. It's all biology, right? Yeah. And then humans separate this incredible distinction of like, oh, they're different. And even Darwin was quoted and famous for this survival of the fittest. And in reality, his final book that he wrote was, he mentioned love 100 times, right? And survival of the fittest very few times. And he said, when on his deathbed, he said, I feel bad for people. This is what they're taking from my philosophy. He goes, 'cause humans are the most successful species on the planet because of empathy. Mm. And we're wired that way in a unique way than animals. Animals have empathy and compassion but humans on a different level, I think. And so,
I think there's a distinction that when we move from the person to the system, that we've been learning a lot at Character Strong as we build curriculum for schools. And the research actually shows that teaching empathy in and of itself doesn't do much in terms of behavioral cultural change. Why? Because you can teach people to feel more deeply or take people's perspective, but just because I feel bad for you does not guarantee that I help you.
Hmm.
I think that's an important distinction. And sometimes schools will spend a bunch of money and time and energy trying to teach empathy, but empathy does not guarantee action, which is where compassion comes in, which is where that capacity to choose to love comes in. And you're right, I love the translation of compassion to suffer with, but psychology takes it a step further. They say compassion is to suffer with someone with an active desire to alleviate that suffering.
Hmm.
So just to sit with someone in their suffering is empathetic, but it doesn't necessarily change things, right? I can feel bad for what's going on in the racial context of our country, but if I don't actually do anything actively to be a part of the solution, right, it's sort of the distinction between being racist or not racist, when in the reality the language is I need to be anti-racist. It's the proactive.
Yeah.
That takes us out of just like, oh, that has to be tough, to how do I change myself, circumstances, or the systems that are broken to alleviate that suffering on an interpersonal level or on a systemic level.
Yeah.
That I think that's the thing that separates us, right? Is our capacity to think on that systems level and to move from suffering with someone to being able to act in love to alleviate that suffering.
Yeah. And yeah, that's the next barrier, I guess, that you take. And I think like what we're evolving to now is, so I think our culture for the Western world, in America at least, was houses, fences, garage doors. It was just like very isolated. And now we're evolving to this co-living, which Denmark and some other Scandinavian countries do really well, where it's subsidized, it's government funded co-living. Mm-hmm. Because now we're just like, wow, we can all feel and learn and empathize and raise our kids together. Like it takes a village, right? Mm-hmm. And even in like, you know, African countries and villages, you know, it's still like that, where it's like everyone knows that you have a family member or a cousin. It's like everyone's on the same team, on the mm-hmm. same page, you know? And I think America, we try our best to survival of the fittest. We tried our best to financially gain. We tried our best to walk over, you know, profit over people kind of thing. And now it's just like, wow, we are the most wealthy country in the world and the most depressed country in the world. So now we're looking at both of these, this paradigm shift. And yeah, it's empathy, it's love, it's kindness. It's everything that for so long science couldn't measure. So they kind of wrote off, and now science and studies and psychology mm-hmm. and people are now, the pendulum's coming back where it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. There is something beyond the borders of our mind, beyond the borders of our instruments that we can measure things with. And it is the unknown. And it is so great and exciting that we are in this revolution, in this revival.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, where that's part of the pain is like undoing a lot of cultural programming, and it doesn't necessarily move as fast as you like it to on a systems mm-hmm. level. But I think, yeah, you're seeing people confront that sometimes our most traditionally successful moments are our most lonely.
Mm-hmm.
I've experienced that. We have friends who've experienced that, who get their companies bought for millions of dollars and they say, I'm miserable. And we all know that story. Like, that's not a new revelation, but it is related to the conversation in the sense of when we fail to recognize that pursuit of independence as being a barrier to compassion, then we give kindness lip service without actually allocating the resources to teach it, because we think we've been told for so long that it is survival of the fittest, that like you got to win and this is what winning looks like. And we don't realize that our metrics have been given to us and maybe aren't the ones that actually make us happy. And I think for many people, you know, we realize that at different chapters in our life, and sometimes it takes pain to pivot. But I think that's where we're at for many people collectively right now, is this recognition of, dang, maybe we've been getting it wrong. And you see it come to life in the reality of the reckoning that we're going through right now, of that level of independence that we've created for each other is the cause of the division that we're now seeing. Because, like I said, empathy in and of itself doesn't necessarily shape up to behavior. And the research on empathy is that we can extend kind actions. We typically only extend kind actions to people that are quote unquote in our circle of care, which means people that I feel bad for and am willing to act towards in love. And we all have limited circles, right? We all have limits. Some people's limits look different, and some people's circle of care, if you think about sort of the intersection of what's in your own life, it might be your religion or your sport or your politics. And as soon as people are on the other side of that invisible line of care, we other them. And we see that happening in the independence we've created in our culture, and now the division that are shaping up as a result of it, is we say we care about each other, but it's only the people that we want to care about.
Yeah.
And I have that argument with friends and family who say like, oh, well, I'm generous. I'm so generous. And I'm like, well, is your generosity conditional? Yeah. Well, if they want my money, they need to do X, Y, and Z. Or if they want my time, then they have to meet these standards. Right? Or if they want my action, like it's targeted towards people that they've declared are the ones that deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the arguments politically when you start to get in the whole like pro-life conversation. Like, well, whose life? And what lives are you pro towards? And is it just this group? Right? Where do those circles of pro-choice? Like all of those things all have circles of care. And I just like that term resonates to me because it's visual.
Mm-hmm.
That I can recognize as I walk through this world, I have circles, whether I'm conscious of them or not, that I am willing to give in. And then I have circles just beyond that one little invisible line, whatever that distinction is to me, where I'm not going to be willing to give. And my argument would be, then we have work to do in kindness.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm always trying to let my audience know, and people too, is just that if you look around and you have the same skin color around you, same beliefs, same, you know, same culture, it's just like you're swimming in a fish jar in the ocean, you know, and you're seeing a very fishbowl. Yeah. You're swimming in a fishbowl in the ocean where you're limited. You're like, it's almost like you're trying to paint this mural of life and you're limited to like a few colors, where it's like you're missing out. Like you are truly missing out if you can't cross the line and go to both. Because at the end of the day, it's not Democrat or Republican, or it's not black or white. It's love and hate, you know, it's fear, love and fear, where it's like you, even if you hate the people who are hating, you're on their side. You're on the same team as them. And so how do you come to the other side? And I know that everyone has their own stories and their own traumas, but how do we be proactive, right? Pro-love, pro-kindness. How do we go above and beyond, not just this simple, you know, this, I don't know. I think the proactive thing is big, you know, where I have something that's kind of controversial that I say a lot that people maybe don't vibe with. I don't know. People say a lot of the times, you know, you put your oxygen mask on first and then the person next to you, or you can't pour from an empty cup. And, that's my mom. Should I get it?
Yeah. You bring her into the conversation.
But what I was saying is, I think potentially, this is just a theory of mine. I'm not saying that's wrong. I get it. I understand where that's coming from. But theory of mine is sometimes helping people when is what fills your cup. Like I'm kind of like, hey, we're always, I feel like sometimes people are like, yo, when I get my life together, when I get my finances together and my time managed together and my relationship together and my family together, then I'll go help people. I'm like, hey, what if helping people help to get all that other stuff together? Like maybe, like that's kind of like how I've approached my life. And I'm not saying it's the right way. It's the way I've tested it out. And I'm kind of like, sometimes when I give to people and I don't have nothing in my cup, it's what fills my cup.
Yeah. Research would support you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. What we know about people who have the ability to do hard things over time is that they have clarity of purpose. And if your clarity of purpose involves serving, which a lot of the research would suggest is good for you physically, mentally, spiritually, then taking care of yourself is living in purpose.
Hmm.
So you're doing both, right? You can put on your own oxygen mask while, right? And it breaks the metaphor, which is good because the metaphor is a little overused and outdated.
Yeah.
And not a lot of people are flying right now anyway. So let's think about the new model of what this metaphor can be, and maybe just forget the metaphor altogether. It's if I live in my purpose and that purpose is bigger than me, it almost always means that I'm serving someone.
Hmm. Always.
I love G.K. Chesterton as a writer and theologian, and he has this great quote that has been adapted by a friend of mine, and the adaptation of the quote would be, how much bigger our life gets when we make ourselves smaller in it.
Hmm.
Most people, as you just described, when I get my finances, my time management, my X, Y, or Z in order, then I'll give. And then your whole life is the size of you.
Hmm.
Versus if my purpose involves, I want to make sure that this need is met, or that I'm serving this group of people, or that I make a difference in this system or this community, all of a sudden my life becomes bigger than me. And all of a sudden, I have a lot more energy because everything doesn't revolve directly around me. And so my successes or failures become about this bigger thing, and my ego has more room to swim, if we want to go back to the water analogy.
Yeah.
And then everything I don't take so personally. And I think that's one of the most effective methods of self-care we could give right now. My co-founder John talks about this all the time. He's like, my self-care is reminding myself of why I do what I do every morning. And I'm exhausted. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I, you know, there is definitely a challenge for me as the individual, but it's bigger than me.
Hmm. So good. Yeah. Yeah. It fuels you, like what that C.K. Chesterton said.
GK Chesterton. Yeah. And the research around support would say that asking for help is really important. Seeking support, valuable. Giving support, at least the research across a lot of different sort of sections of quote unquote wellness would suggest that giving support is better for you physically, mentally, emotionally than getting support.
So good. I love it. That's amazing.
Science.
Okay, so we talked a lot about cool stuff. Real quick, so we're coming up on 50 minutes, but I want to personalize it again. So how old are you right now?
31.
31. Okay, you're younger than me. That's awesome. You're sitting with a 24-year-old. Maybe your 24-year-old self. What do you say to a 24-year-old right now in this culture, in this context? That's just like, or your 24-year-old self.
I say that trust matters, and that they've done surveys in businesses and schools and all over the place for 30 years asking what's the number one quality you want in a relationship. And it's for 30 years, pretty consistently trust. What does trust break down to? What are the ingredients of trust? I think about it as empathy, authenticity, and consistency. So what are you doing to listen? What are you doing to identify your purpose and find ways to align yourself to it? It's authenticity. And then what are you doing to be consistent? Meaning, are you making promises to yourself and keeping them? Are you making promises to other people and keeping them effectively? And I think in some ways, the success I found personally in how I think about success is because I've pursued something with diligence and relentlessness. And I think you find the learning that I've found in the past year made the past 10 years really worth it. Because I have found a level of detail in my storytelling, my understanding of something like kindness, which you can spend years just sort of like rolling around the same topics and conversations. And it's really in this past year that like I have found a lot of beauty in the minutiae and things that people don't typically arrive at because they're not willing to look that long. So I think if I were to tell my 24-year-old self something, if I tell any 24-year-old something, is find ways to cultivate trust because it's the most important foundation of all relationships in your life. Relationships are your entire life. So figure out how to listen, figure out how to be authentic in those conversations, to fail beautifully and to realign yourselves when you need to, and then think about what it means to do something with consistency. Enough consistency over time that you might look at something that you once thought was ordinary and say, dang, this is beautiful.
So good. So good, man. Mic drop. I love it because I think another way, just the last thing I'm going to say on that is it's a marathon. This is a long race we're in. And I think right now we are in instant gratification land. We are in instant followers and apps. And like, just like when you said we're getting 130 gigs of data in our system, and our system can only process, let's say 15, 20 gigs a day. So we're like inundated with all these emotions and feelings, and then we're trying to like it's a marathon. It's a long race. So stay consistent. And I think, you know, you being 31, I'm 32, and we're still making new discoveries when it comes to community, to ourself, to relationships. And so it's not a mountaintop you hit. It is not a level of success. You will write this book, you're going to release this book, and you're going to have all this amazing stuff come from it and breakthroughs and people's lives change. And then you just be like, all right, well, what's the next thing? And I don't want to give people like this. It's never going to happen. It's this thing. It's a dance. Life is like Alan Watts, right? It's a dance. Yeah. We're not here to just go to a concert and hear the last cymbal of like the orchestra, right? It's like we have to learn to dance through the chaos, to dance through the highs and lows.
My favorite Alan Watts.
It's the best. Yeah. So I love you, bro.
Love you.
This was awesome. Thanks so much for coming on. This is the final podcast in this room and with this wall. And Perry and I built this. We have a video on YouTube of us building it. It's really funny. And I kind of was sitting here. It's been an emotional week. It's been like just a lot of different emotions with leaving the space. And this was the first place I ever got where I had roots. Because at Yes Theory House, me and Perry were like traveling the world those 2 years.
Yeah.
So, and then your house was like, you know, this, and then I moved into here and it was like the roots. It was like me getting roots and investing in myself. It was like the highest rent I've ever paid. And when I moved in September 2 years ago, I had exactly enough money in my bank account to cover that month's rent, and took that leap of faith and then sustained it for 2 years. But I don't know, just a lot of emotions. And so I was like, man, how do I want to end this? It's crazy that you're releasing the book, but then I was like, how do I want to end this? And I was like, you're someone who's always been on the list, obviously, and couldn't get a hold of, obviously, but we got him, boys. So yeah, I'm so thankful that you helped. What's the thing that, you know, you close the ceremony? I don't know what's called.
Frienders.
Yeah. Yeah.
We ended the friended.
That's in right. The podcast. We just hit 50 minutes. Anything else you want to say? Podcast. When's your book drop?
September 29th. It's called Deep Kindness.
September 29th. Please write that down. You can pre-order it on Amazon.
You can. Yeah, right now.
Please pre-order it. And that was like the coolest thing, is you can pre-order it and then buy a couple from your family and friends. And then on the launch date, we're going to do a conference.
Yep.
And I'm going to be on the conference. Yeah. And amazing people will be on the conference. And it's going to be a whole day event. Yeah. So write it down in your book right now.
It'll be free. Drop in. You can listen to people like BC and other people who... not as good looking, but smarter than him.
Yes.
You'll check it out. It's going to be called the Kindness Conversational Conference.
Oh, that's good. That's a lot of K's. That's all K's.
That's not correct. Once again, not as good looking, but definitely smarter.
Yeah, I'm tall.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I know it. Don't I know it?
But you got the brains.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
I love you, bro.
Love you too,
I love
man.
You guys who's listening. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Leave reviews. I'm bad at this because I don't really know how to do it. But yeah, leave reviews.
I can help. Yeah.
Okay.
You should subscribe, download an episode. If you leave a review, it helps in the metrics in the podcast. So, and that, of course, is on the Character Strong podcast. For BC, you can kind of do whatever you need.
CharacterStrong.com/org. All right, guys. Love you all. Take care. Hope this was awesome. Please share it. Please subscribe. And please leave a comment and follow Houston and his mission and his movement. Love you all. Peace.